From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, white supremacist violence in Charlottesville. The president blames both sides. Terror in Barcelona, Steve Bannon speaks, North Korea. Terror and death in Charlottesville last weekend after white nationalists gathered with chants straight out of the Nazi era. At Trump Tower Tuesday, President Trump equated white supremacists with the people protesting against them.
I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it.
And carnage in Spain. CBS reporter Deborah Pata described the terror attack in Barcelona that's left more than a dozen dead and at least 100 injured.
People ran for their lives, screaming as the attacker driving a white van jumped the sidewalk and plowed into a crowd of tourists and locals. In his wake, bodies strewn across the pavement.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Yamiche Alcindor of the New York Times, Margaret Brennan of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on how does this country go forward with a president equivocating on white supremacy. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington, Yamiche Alcindor, national reporter for the New York Times. She's been closely following the aftermath of the events in Charlottesville. Yamiche, thank you very much for being with us again.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Bedminster, New Jersey, is Margaret Brennan, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. She's been traveling with the president this week. Margaret Brennan, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty's with us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Yamiche, and Margaret.
Let's just go back to that contentious press conference in Trump Tower on Tuesday. President Trump tearing into the media for the way it had reported the weekend violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, equated white supremacists with counter-protesters.
That was a horrible, horrible day. Wait a minute. I'm not finished. I'm not finished, fake news. That was a horrible day. I will tell you something. I watched those very closely, much more closely than you people watched it. And you had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that.
But the president just did. He put it just that way, a kind of equivalency drawn there. Said, no, I don't favor neo-Nazis, but let's look at this and the net effect, a kind of equivalency drawn. Margaret Brennan, where does the president stand at the end of this week within his own party? And for that matter, you're covering foreign affairs in the eyes of the world.
Well, this is something that rhetorically and morally the president did to himself and an unforced error that he really didn't have to in any way not only commit but go anywhere close to having said. And because of that, he has drawn, well, not he himself, but the sentiments that he seemingly not only failed to fully condemn, but almost equivocated with and normalized with the protesters, has drawn scorn from not only the German chancellor, but our closest allies in Israel, because it just seemingly tried to normalize absolutely abhorrent behavior on part of some of the protesters who were associating themselves with the KKK, with neo-Nazis. And because of that, that presence, and Newt Gingrich said it, the presence of those individuals associated with those hate groups in many ways sent anyone who perhaps was a quote-unquote very nice person home that day. That the president's implication that there were people who were just mixed into the crowd unwittingly was not an accurate one. But the president that day really, and I was there at Trump Tower, was seething with anger. A lot of this really, it seemed, had to do with his personal upset as to how he was being treated and how he felt was being misrepresented. He felt he did his job on Saturday when he condemned all groups but didn't name them. He felt that this was questioning him in a way that was unfair and other presidents wouldn't have been treated that way. And that is what came through more so than the racial sentiment. The issue is this is just such a toxic one and one you don't riff on. You don't just throw these words and these groups out there, and it will, because it is just so dangerous and can incite even more anger. And so the president now, to answer your question more directly, is having deep problems within his own party. You had Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. You had Tim Scott, another Republican from South Carolina, saying that the president really is abdicating his moral responsibility here and questioning whether he's fit for the presidency.
We had members of his own party. This was Republican Congressman from Texas, Will Hurd, on CNN. After President Trump said both sides were to blame for the violence in Charlottesville, Blitzer asked the Republican congressman what he had to say to the president. Here's the Republican's response.
Apologize. And that racism, bigotry, anti-Semitism of any form is unacceptable. And the leader of the free world should be unambiguous about that.
Unambiguous. He was not, and there's been fallout all week long. Top business chief, CEO, stepping down from a couple of his economic advisory councils this week after the violence, and more. Off the manufacturing council, we had Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, who's been very supportive of the president on expanding manufacturing in this country. Spoke Wednesday on CBS this morning about why he had stepped down from the manufacturing advisory council.
When he tried to put equal blame on both sides, when these organizations at their stem and at their core are based on racism and bigotry, that's unacceptable. That's an un-American value. And when he gave that defense to them, it became too much for us to be associated with that.
And the mayor of Charlottesville himself, Mike Signer, this was even before Tuesday, saying that President Trump's rhetoric had laid the groundwork over time to embolden white supremacist groups. Mike Signer.
He should look in the mirror. I mean, he made a choice in his presidential campaign, the folks around with him, to, you know, to go right to the gutter, to play on our worst prejudices. And I think you were seeing a direct line from what happened here this weekend to those choices.
Yeah, Michelle Cinder, we've heard sounds from the white supremacist community, white nationalists, of feeling comforted and emboldened by what the president said, despite his assertion that he was not supporting them.
Well, I think that I'll start off by saying between 1882 and 1968, 4,743 people were lynched across this country. And I think that that's from the perspective that I have to speak from, because the context here is that we're talking about groups that not only just said racist things, not only just did racist things, chanted, maybe went around the University of Virginia and scared some students, but that the history of these groups are that they actually meticulously killed people and as for all intents and purposes, carried out domestic terrorism for decades. So I think when we think about the president putting them both on a moral playing field, he's really, as Margaret said, it's a self-inflicted wound in that this was a slam dunk for him politically. He could have just gone out there and said on Saturday, this is terrible, Nazis are terrible, KKKs are terrible, and he could have then moved on so that by the time lawmakers come back in a week or two, that they could move on to all of the legislative things that Republicans want to do. Instead, he has all these Republicans from Tim Scott to Bob Corker now calling him out. And so I've interviewed so many Republicans who are now wondering whether or not, one, they can continue to support the president, and two, whether or not they can continue to be in the party. Now, I should say that I interviewed an African-American man who's a supporter of Donald Trump, who's from Baltimore, who said he understood what the president was saying. That man told me that President Trump was accurate in the fact that there could be nice people among the KKK. And again, this is coming from an African-American supporter of the president. But I think overall, the backlash that President Trump is feeling is that both reporters and his own party realized that he was making a mistake here.
Maybe. I mean, we'll look at the numbers. The polling here says that Republicans in general, 67% approve of President Trump's response to the Charlottesville attack. That leaves plenty who may not. That leaves plenty who do. We've seen some interesting expressions of that. On Wednesday, the day after, Republican analyst Jenna Caldwell appeared on Fox and Friends, and he and a liberal commentator were supposed to talk about removing Confederate statues. Instead, he teared up as he discussed President Trump's comments about the violence in Charlottesville.
Mr. President, good people don't pile around with Nazis and white supremacists. Maybe they don't consider themselves white supremacists and Nazis, but certainly they hold those views. This has become very troubling, and for anyone to come on any network and defend what President Trump did and said at that press conference yesterday is completely lost in the potential to be morally bankrupt.
Jack Beatty, what has happened in this country in this week? I mean, since we last sat here and talked just a week ago,
we saw what happened in Charlottesville, and we saw a president respond to it in a way I have never seen before from a sitting U.S. president. What are we looking at, Jack?
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine. I mean, he seemed to have crossed a new frontier of disgrace this week. I mean, he degraded his office. I mean, The Economist caught it in their cover. They show a cover of the president shouting through a megaphone that's in the shape of a Klan hood, and they write, "Trump is politically inept, morally barren, and temporarily unfit for office." That's a view that he gave much credence to this week in his actions, and as Margaret suggests, is there politics behind this, and is this, you know, an effort to stoke white grievance, and therefore these subsequent tweets about the, you know, keeping up the Confederate statues, is that an effort to, you know, pander to that vote, or was the whole thing the Tuesday meltdown about personal slight? A feeling that he didn't get the credit he deserved for, you know, making that, as someone said, hostage tape on Monday, where he just recited the words and everyone said, well, at least finally he's recognized that neo-Nazism is appalling. He seemed to have resented his staff sort of forced him into that, and then he didn't get enough credit for it, and the result was this narcissistic meltdown.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
Candlelight vigil there on Wednesday, the day after the president's comments in Trump Tower. That in Charlottesville on the campus of the University of Virginia campus. We're looking at a week in the news, terror in Charlottesville, dismay at the president's response, white supremacists emboldened, the Barcelona terror attack. Margaret Brennan is with us, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Yamiche Alcindor here from the New York Times, national reporter there. Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join us. What do you say to Republican Senator Bob Corker's observation that this president has not shown the stability or competence to succeed in the job? Were the business leaders, the CEOs, right to step off of Trump's manufacturing board this week, the board that he later just disbanded entirely? Here again from the president at Trump Tower on Tuesday.
What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt?
Yeah, what about that, said the president, and how far does this go? Here he was.
This week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
The president there equating leaders of the Confederacy, military leaders, with the founders of the nation. And yesterday, meeting with reporters in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Republican Senator from Tennessee, Bob Corker, said the president needs to make radical changes in the White House and question the president's stability, competence.
The president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence that he needs to demonstrate in order to be successful.
Margaret Brennan, what happens here? Does the White House just roll forward? Do we just, okay, that all happened. Now it'll be a new week next week, and this is done? Or do you see a lasting chain of consequences?
Look, this is a White House staff that rolls from controversy to controversy, has survived controversy through the next one. But this is an explosion in terms of the amount of criticism, not only from the press, but from world leaders, from members within, and very prominent members from within the president's own Republican Party. You play that sound from Senator Bob Corker, a senator who is typically circumspect, who has at times been a supporter of the president, who does not just pop off about things. He chooses his words very carefully, and that is a game changer in terms of reading where the party is, if you consider the Republican Party to be one right now. And that's a bigger question, whether, you know, how many Republican parties and conservative groups are there within the tent these days. But it could, in many ways, so complicate the president's agenda. And every time you talk to a White House official, a very prominent one like Gary Cohn, the National Economic Council director, who was standing beside the president, mm-hmm. visibly dismayed, as the president in Trump Tower was really having more of an argument than a press conference. For individuals like him who are here to get things done, who want to answer questions about roads and bridges and tax cuts and infrastructure investment, Elaine Chao, the transportation secretary, who stunningly, after that press conference, got back in the elevator, came back down with charts to answer questions as if that exchange had not happened in the first place. It is amazing to see officials continue to say, no, we're standing by the president's side. Not a single one of them has left the administration right now. And if anything, you have this doubling down on, let's just try to get something done on the agenda. But the president, in his rhetoric this week, made it so much harder for them to do that. He put them in such an odd position to have to even begin to field questions about neo-Nazis when they want to talk about tax cuts, when they want to talk about doing things and argue that they themselves are in this for all the right reasons in terms of serving the public good. So I have no doubt that these officials go home and have conversations with themselves and their loved ones that they would not dare to have with reporters. But at this point, none of them are leaving his side. Vice President Pence is flying home to be at his side a day early from this foreign trip. And what I do think is interesting, though, and I want to underscore, is Chief of Staff John Kelly, new to this job, former Marine general, is, you know, they say, once a Marine, always Marine, really trying to establish command and control of the staff. He clearly cannot control the president's own messaging. Today, he's taking him to Camp David to try to focus, get him out of there, get him out of here, focus him in on an issue, one of the most consequential of his young presidency, which is what to do about Afghanistan. The job of president didn't stop this week because of what the president said. And so somehow they're trying to push through this to get things done. But the question is, politically, will he be able to get anything done in Washington by making enemies of the people who he needs to make allies with?
The job didn't change. The standing may have changed. This was Fox News, Shepard Smith the next day, talking about how Fox News tried to get Republicans to come on air to defend President Trump's remarks on Charlottesville.
Our booking team, and they're good, reached out to Republicans of all stripes across the country today. Let's be honest, Republicans often don't really mind coming on Fox News Channel. We couldn't get anyone to come and defend him here.
And here's Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, the only black Republican in the U.S. Senate, talked with Vice News in an interview aired yesterday, questioned the president's moral authority after those Tuesday comments in Charlottesville.
His comments on Monday were strong. His comments on Tuesday started erasing the comments that were strong. What we want to see from our president is clarity and moral authority, and that moral authority is compromised when Tuesday happens. There's no question about that.
But Tuesday happened. Donald in Fairfield, Iowa. Donald, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Briefly, before my comment, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate your show. You know, civil discourse is exactly what I think this country needs right now, and you bring it every single day. My comments are about, you know, the administration this week and, like, what Donald Trump said. I think that in some way they think this helps them politically, that all these denunciations from the news media and other people in government come from people who never voted, never really supported Trump that much. And, you know, those of us who said he was a threat to this country, that he was incompetent and dangerous, we've been right at every turn. And, you know, in my opinion, you cannot count on this president. Don't look to him. Don't expect anything from him. Work around him. And that's just how it is in this country right now, from my perspective.
Donald,
and, thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your call, Donald. Yamiche, do you see the possibility, is there a political calculus here that the president and his advisors, maybe Steve Bannon, think will help him in these comments? Or is this just a personal urge to make these remarks just as they were?
I think it's a little bit of both. As someone who traveled with President Trump when he was out on the campaign trail and interviewed dozens of his supporters, they loved and ate up what he said on the campaign trail when everyone else was calling it offensive. When the Access Hollywood tape came out, I was interviewing women from in North Carolina, in Ohio, who were saying that they were not at all moved by it, the fact that they thought it was locker room talk, that their husbands might have talked like that. So I think Donald Trump is doubling down because he's always been able to be himself, and he's been rewarded for being himself because now he's sitting in the presidency. So I think that when we see him doubling down, when we see him saying, I don't want to deal with these notes, I actually want to tell you exactly how I feel and you people don't understand me, then I think he's really speaking to a specific part of the country that essentially got him elected. That being said, I think now that he's realizing that he's bumping up against actual governing and that his legacy could possibly be someone who has passed no major legislation and was essentially just remembered as someone who boasted boasted the white supremacists and Nazis, I think it's maybe starting to sink in that maybe possibly this wasn't the right thing to do. But that said, I also have to think that Speaker Paul Ryan just yesterday was emailing people, emailing members of the press, talking about tax reform and talking about creating jobs. So there's this feeling that Republicans are getting ready to pivot already. I think that Republicans are absolutely going to work with this president. And all the reporting that I've done, including talking to Black Republicans like Tim Scott, if you listen closely to what he's saying, yes, I think the president is compromised, but I'm still a Republican, so I still want to deal with the policies that we want to pass. So as a result, you're going to see Republicans, I think, work with the president as long as he's in office.
How does that play out, Yamiche? I mean, they may work with him on policy. It didn't work so well on health care, but we'll see what happens there. But at the same time, you clearly have and explicitly have an emboldened white nationalist, white supremacist movement in this party with straight up fascists in their ranks. The president and the Republicans can do what they like in Washington, but this is now emboldened in the nation, Yamiche. How do these two things live side by side?
I think they live side by side by Republicans coming on your show or talking to me and pivoting as much as possible. I think Republicans from now until whenever President Trump leaves office, but be it through whatever means, that they are going to be bringing up tax reforms and health care, and they're going to be saying, yes, we did not really like what the president said, but now as a party, we have to unite together and pass the policies that we want to pass. So I think that Republicans are going to absolutely not want to talk about this. They're talking about it now because it's something that's fresh, but I think in 2 weeks, Republicans are going to start saying, you know what, that's over. We're done with that. Everyone understands that Nazis are bad, but we now have to support the president in the things that we can get passed.
But every time there's a new parade of swastikas down some American street, we've got the issue again in our face, in their faces, everyone's.
I think they're going to pivot. I think they're going to spin like no one's ever seen them spin before. I think that this is going to be something where Republicans might send out a tweet, might send out a Facebook posting. But I think in terms of actually dealing with the issue, I see very little evidence through my reporting that Republicans are going to do anything more than say that it's bad form, but continue to work with the president.
Dolores in Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a couple points. I see no difference between ISIS and these white supremacists, KKK Nazis. I throw them all in one bag. ISIS wishes to establish a caliphate. The white nationalists, their agenda is to establish a white America, and both of them push violence in order to reach their agenda. And we need to take into heart these statements by our senior military officials. Any association with any of the white nationalist groups.
And we should say on that front what you're referring to, they sharply distance themselves from the right. president's view here. The right. U.S. military leader is very interesting in itself.
Right. And even tattoos is against military policy. And that in itself is subject to discharge. And then you look at the so-called commander-in-chief's points versus the comments from the senior officials. And they're on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Well, senior officials, when you talk about military, many others, like Paul Ryan, said, no, we don't want Nazis, we don't want these things. But he didn't pin it on the president. You had military brass pushing specifically back against any kind of equivocating on this. Because, of course, our military ranks are extremely diverse, as is our country. And that's what they have to lead. Donna in Largo, Florida. Donna, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I have a couple of things that I would like to talk about. Number one, nobody's speaking of the danger of future. And what I mean by that is within the administration, you have Bannon, Gorka, Miller, all sympathizers of white nationalists. And you have a president who's picking federal judges. Now, one of their goals, one of the white nationalist goals, which they've said, is to have representation in the government. And they have representation in the government now.
Well, I mean, we heard them saying this week, we heard David Duke and others saying, thank you, Mr. President, in effect, for just the way you framed this, and we're grateful for it. On the other hand, you had Steve Bannon. Donna, thanks for your call. You had Steve Bannon talking with Robert Kuttner, co-editor, founder of the American Prospect magazine, and Bannon, Kuttner reported, was quite dismissive of the far right, of ethno-nationalism. Here's Kuttner describing what Bannon had to say.
He starts out by saying very nasty things about the far right. He says, ethno-nationalism, it's losers. It's a fringe element. We got to help crush it, crush them. So this is, and then he says these guys are a collection of clowns.
That is Robert Kuttner describing Steve Bannon's remarks on Morning Edition. Margaret, what do you make of those Bannon remarks on this front, on the what he called the fringe element, ethno-nationalists, very much on display in Charlottesville?
Well, it's interesting he made the remarks at all. Depending on who you believe and when they say it, it was either a knowingly on the record or accidentally on the record interview from a man who never gives interviews but once ran a media company. So it seems that the remarks deserve a lot of analysis here. And one of the things that he said is that, as you just played, it seemed that Steve Bannon, one of the chief advisors to the president, was building a wall between himself or the group politically he represents or believes he represents and some of those who associate themselves with white supremacists.
But he ran Breitbart News, which he himself described as the platform for the alt-right.
That's right. And this is one of those smattering of groups. Alt-right is such an umbrella term, but there are white supremacists who clearly in Charlottesville vocally associated themselves with that moniker,
sure,
alt-right. But what was more interesting to me is while he seems to be distancing himself, he then quickly turned, Steve Bannon, and talked about them being politically useful. Yeah, they're clowns. Yeah, they're a fringe element. But they're very politically useful because, as he put it, if we get liberals and Democrats to continue to focus on race as an issue, it'll be a distraction. Basically saying that, you know, while inflaming racial and to ethnic tensions might be bad, it's actually politically useful for us to get done what we want to get done. In other words, using it as a tool, not necessarily as an ideology, if it is that at all. But it was one of the more cynical takes, and in some ways acknowledging that there is an association, or at least, you know, if he calls them clowns, you want to call them useful idiots, that's how he seemed to be characterizing their association.
Jack, Nazis in our streets in the last week, and here we are talking about maybe that's useful politically. How does this sort out politically in this country, Jack? We now have this white supremacist vision clearly standing right there, the president not distancing himself from it very far and equivocating. If this is politically useful, where do we go?
Yeah, and how can it be useful? A wedge issue around neo-Nazism. Who would have thought that's possible in America? And yet here we have Bannon telling Bob Kuttner, go to the Democrats, tear down more of those statues. I can't get enough of it. That's what we want. Democrats do identity politics, and we'll fan white resentment. But, Tom, just a point. We're not helpless before this. USA Today essentially called the Republicans in a very important editorial. They said, Republicans, put your votes where your tweets are. And basically they say it is time for a congressional resolution of censure for the president's remarks on the moral equivalence. And in fact, today, three Democrats are introducing a motion of censure. It's happened before in American history, and the USA Today says, this is the party of Lincoln. Do they want to be remembered as the party of Trump? Here's their chance.
Yamiche, can you see that the censure passing Congress?
I, as of right now, based on my reporting, would not be able to see that passing.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, late-night hosts put aside their jokes after the president's remarks at his Trump Tower press conference Tuesday. Here's Jimmy Fallon.
We all need to stand against what is wrong, acknowledge that racism exists, and stand up for what is right and civil and kind, and to show the next generation that we haven't forgotten how hard people have fought for human rights. We cannot do this. We can't go backward.
Late night host Seth Meyers also took a serious tone after that Trump press conference.
His job is to lead, to cajole, to scold, to correct our path, to lift up what is good about us, and to absolutely and unequivocally and immediately condemn what is evil in us. And if he does not do that, if he does not preside over our society, then he is not a president.
And on other fronts, a jury ruled in favor of pop star Taylor Swift in her countersuit against a former radio host who groped her at a meet and greet in 2013. Here's Swift's lawyer, Doug Baldridge.
It gives courage and inspiration to all people, not just women, but to all people, to have the courage to draw lines and to know where those lines are.
We're looking at this week in the news, terror in Charlottesville, dismay at the president's response, white supremacists emboldened the Barcelona terror attack. Yamiche Alcindor is with us, national reporter for the New York Times, Margaret Brennan, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty is here. What do you make of this week? What do we say after all Europe's attacks to Barcelona? What do you think of the president tweeting mythology in response on General Pershing in the Philippines? And which message on North Korea should our allies hear? There is no military solution, or we're ready with a military solution. A couple more on Charlottesville and its aftermath, and then we'll got to move on. Byron in Blanco, Texas. Byron, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So the president of the United States has now aligned himself with neo-Nazis, treasonous Confederate leaders, and white Christian terrorists.
He said he's not in favor of neo-Nazis. He explicitly said that. I mean, do you buy it, given the rest of what he said?
No, I don't buy it, because I think that it's been pretty clear that he has made it too ambiguous. And I think that the silence spoke a lot louder than his words, his belated words. In short, I really don't think that this president has more than 18 months left in office. Looking at congressional elections next year, the ones that are being vocal are the ones that are in the worst spots, like Arizona, maybe Tennessee. They're running tighter races, but
well, that might change Congress, but that doesn't change who sits in the White House, does it, Byron?
Oh, it does. If it turns into him having to force a resign, because there's going to either be an impeachment process coming soon, or there's going to have to be we're going to have to depose him. We're worried about nuclear war with North Korea. I think that the Speaker of the House, Mitch McConnell, and the Vice President must already be conferring on how to prepare for a situation to get him deposed if he tries to nuke the planet. I mean, we're looking at this as a serious conversation here.
Byron, I appreciate your call. Margaret, you're right there in the White House. You've been at the president's golf resort in Bedminster. Do you hear any of that kind of talk of resignation, impeachment, anything that will actually change the situation? Byron's looking from Texas, and, you know, it seems acute to him.
And I understand why, given the unending news flow here, but no, in a practical sense, I don't hear that. And what I do hear, however, is, again, 3 weeks in, a new chief of staff, General John Kelly, who is really trying to crack the whip and trying to establish order when it comes to information flow, when it comes to communication. But we saw the limits of his ability to keep the president on message on Tuesday. You saw the limits of what he can do in terms of controlling staff with Steve Bannon picking up the phone unprompted to a reporter and describing his personal convictions on North Korea and China, not only undercutting the president's position, but that of his military advisors, and possibly even revealing information that was so sensitive that it is, considered dangerous. And he's not in the position as national security. He's not a national security figure, but he finds it important enough for him to be expressing these views and making them public. These are things that are underscoring in many ways that the tug of war within the administration, that's what I'm seeing, is that the tug of war to try to establish some level of control here with a president who has made a virtue out of being flexible, chaotic in many ways, and a management skill, and an office that really demands order, that demands constraint, that demands an appreciation of the protocols and the moral authority that goes or has gone in the past with the office of the presidency. So impeachment is something you hear quite often on cable news and from Democrats, but I do not hear it in terms of, at the level of the president, a real concern.
Yamiche, I mean, what about non-white Americans this week? You know, you among them, watching this president with his remarks, seeing what we saw in the street with all kinds of symbols of oppression being waved and you know, straight up shouted there, phrases back from neo-Nazi and KKK time. How does this very large part of America, one day likely its majority, live with this kind of sentiment in the White House?
I mean, one of the first stories I wrote after President Trump was elected that night, I started interviewing Black Lives Matter activists, and I interviewed the family of Eric Garner around 2 a.m. in the morning on election night, because I was already so moved to understand that people were going to be scared of living under this president. So now fast forward something like 8 months and he's in office, and people call me all the time and people are really terrified. I know people that have been, and I'm talking about like not only activists, but people who worked in the Obama administration, who have been in therapy because they're so worried about what could happen under this president. And I should say that I think what's important and what Virginia is showing us, that it's not only people of color who are taking a stand. Heather, as a white woman dying at that
Heather
rally,
Heyer, is, who run over by the guy and killed, along with many others wounded, yes?
Yeah, I think Heather being killed reminds the nation that this is really an American issue, and that Black people and Hispanic people cannot carry this burden on their own, that the nation as a whole is really terrified. And I think that when I look at those images of protesters fighting, and you see in that Vice documentary that was so powerful, that you saw on both sides white young white Americans fighting each other. And in the history of America, we've always been able to tell who's on which side based on their race. You think of the lunch counters, you think of Selma, you always think of Black people being beat up by the police. In this case, young white kids were fighting each other together. And I thought to myself, this is what America's going to kind of need in some ways, because white Americans are also going to have to step up and say, is this what I appreciate? Is this how this country is going to be? And I think that we're seeing, and what my reporting tells me, is that there's a whole new generation of white people, as well as older white people who remember the civil rights movement, who are saying, absolutely not. This is not the direction that we want our country to go in.
Bruce, yes, Jack, please.
I was just going to say, yes, seeing white people standing up for against this evil is moving. On the other hand, and one of our callers, Donna, raised the question of the future. We're going to see more of these alt-right rallies, and at them, we're going to see members of this loose group called Antifa. I recommend to anyone reading an article in the Atlantic Monthly by Peter Beinart called The Rise of the Violent Left. And he looks at this group, and their view basically is that violence against the people who advocate what the marchers were in Charlottesville is justified, because and that their aim is to shut down the public space for these fascists that they see to speak. And to use violence to do that if necessary. You know, Tolstoy, I think, had it right. The difference between the violence of the left and the violence of the right is the difference between cat excrement and dog excrement.
What's the difference between what you're saying there, Jack, and what the president said on Tuesday?
I mean, I think the president went way beyond that. But what I'm trying to say is, the PBS NewsHour documented this, there were people in the protesters' ranks who were game for violence. And I think that, you know, the whole point of, we live in a nation where we have to have tolerance, and that even means tolerance of the views we hate. Ortega Yigaset said that tolerance is an acrobatic willingness to share existence with the other. It's damn hard, but that's what our system is about.
But what about
Antifa,
those, Jack, who fear?
I mean,
these are swastikas in the street. These are neo-Nazis. Read what they say, and it's straight up, you know, talk about white supremacy. I mean, there's genocide. Stuff in what they're saying.
But one of the things that's so important, though, is the fact that, and I've written about this, is that unfortunately, and I'm not advocating violence in any way at all, but unfortunately, violence sometimes works. You think on the other side about those 4,763 people that were lynched, though, the people that were doing that violence, their point of views were absolutely made clear, and they were terrifying people, which was exactly their point. And then when you look at the violence on the side of protesters, people who don't agree with them, you think of Ferguson, Missouri, where people were kind of interested of the story when Michael Brown was dead. But as soon as that gas station was burned down in Ferguson, it became a national news story. And that's problematic because some people see violence as a means to getting the media to really pay attention.
We're all paying attention right now. I mean, Jack, you must see why people would want to resist when you've got people out there with Nazi chants. Whose streets? Our streets. And we know the history here of how it went down in Germany when this was the perspective, when this was the chant.
Oh, it's dangerous.
Blood and soil.
Yes, but what also went on in Germany was out-and-out street battles between communists and Nazis that turned the Weimar Republic into a sign of charnel house.
Is Antifa communist? Were the protesters communist? You say they're game for violence, but did you see the arms on the people who were surrounding the park there, the white nationalists in Charlottesville? I didn't see anything like that on the other side.
What, no, neither did I.
Okay, we've got to move. We've got Barcelona this week and a really terrible toll there. More than a dozen dead, 100 injured. Here's Ali Shirinzinha witnessing the terror attack in Barcelona yesterday, talking with CNN about what he saw.
I saw it plow into, you know, the merchants, the pedestrians. I saw people flying over the vehicle, just flying, you know, all around the vehicle. And it was just a really, really horrific scene of you know, immediate carnage.
Margaret Brennan, you cover foreign affairs. We've seen so many of these attacks. I mean, now we've seen it in Charlottesville, a car driven into a crowd of protesters. But here in Barcelona, yet again, we have, this was a pretty good-sized van driven very deliberately, very maliciously, weaving to hit people down the main sort of tourist drag of Barcelona, Las Ramblas there, and so many dead. Is there any effective European response to this on the rails, Margaret?
Well, look, this is a cheap and easy method of mass killing, whether it's a white supremacist driving the car or whether it is someone who claims to be, you know, aligned with ISIS, although our reporting at CBS now seems to indicate that this is more than just claiming to be aligned with ISIS, that there may be more of a plot behind it. But what I would say is, look, this is an individual country of Spain. We have a good intelligence sharing relationship with them, and this is something that is virtually impossible to stop, which is why you had the NYPD and other police departments around this country trying to shore up security. I mean, there are guardrails put in to try to keep cars from being able to veer off accidentally or deliberately, but you can't keep a driver and someone who's willing to harm himself from doing this and continuing to do this.
Tough to stop, but on the other hand, Jack, we've heard a lot about, well, we're just going to have to get used to a certain amount of risk, and that's just the way that this world is. But 13 or more dead, 100 injured, what city, what country can just tolerate that?
Yes, but how to end it is the question. I mean, the facts on the ground are working against ISIS in the Middle East. Territory is shrinking every day, but the virus is out there. The bacillus is out there. It's infecting young minds all over the world. And, you know, the effect finally within the European and perhaps even American body politic could be to drive people to the right, toward authoritarianism. That's the big danger that ISIS has. Not that it's going to hurt us by anything it does, but by what it, sort of the antibodies that it creates in our system.
Yes. Margaret?
One of the things that even White House officials will acknowledge is that there has been more acts of domestic violence in the U.S. in terms of like this kind of domestic terrorism than there have been actual acts of Islamic terrorism or so-called Islamic terrorism on U.S. soil. It is the fear and the rhetoric around it that has really been amplified and used actually very politically to his advantage by President Trump. It was really a sharp contrast just yesterday to see President Trump react so quickly to Barcelona to condemn it as an act of terrorism within hours when he took days when it came to Charlottesville, was far more circumspect in his advisors would claim. Others criticized him for being far too delayed in actually describing the events on the ground and how he portrayed them. But then for him to go on Twitter and, as you at the start of the program referenced, perpetuate a false debunked myth about an American general to say this is how terrorists should be dealt with. If you look into that story that the president referenced there, it's one he repeated time and again on the campaign trail. There's very little fact to back it up.
This is General Pershing in the Philippines a century ago. The myth that he put pig's blood on bullets fighting Muslim counterforces there, and that they then stood down, but they did not.
Right, and the idea in and of itself is calling for the, it is in some ways extolling the mass murder of Muslim soldiers in this example, something that, you know, the military code of conduct for our military would not sign off on. The commander-in-chief seemed to endorse it. And of course, that's again another racially, ethnically infused issue that he plunged himself into and did not need to, but sees it as a sign of strength.
Margaret, very quickly, we just got half a minute left here. Steve Bannon says no military solution in North Korea. We've got Rex Tillerson saying the prepared military. We've got General Mattis saying this weekend, I assure you, you know, there'll be big military consequences if North Korea initiates hostilities. Where does administration policy stand as we speak right now on North Korea?
They're trying to lower tensions and push diplomatic talks to try to get any kind of deal here, any kind of negotiation. They haven't gotten the North Koreans to agree to take the steps that the U.S. wants to see before they sit down at the table. So this credible threat of military force is what makes diplomacy possible, and Steve Bannon undercut it by saying at the White House they don't believe there even is a credible threat of military force, something that contradicted the Defense Secretary, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the President himself.
Margaret Brennan, White House correspondent for CBS News, thank you very much for being with us today. Margaret. Yamiche Alcindor, national reporter for the New York Times, joining us from Washington. Yamiche, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Michael DeSocio, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Camila Kerwin, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Allison Poli, and James Ross. With help from Yumi Araki, Alvin Baenza, Eve Monti, and Carrie Ann Mamba. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.